Willkommen zum Bewegungsarten-Podcast. Präsentiert von Trivolution Training. Mit dabei sind eure Hosts Gregor Buchholz und Matthias Knossalla.
Willkommen, liebe Zuhörer, zu einer neuen Folge vom Bewegungsarten-Podcast. Wir wurden ja schon vorgestellt von unserem super neuen, ganz neuen professionellen Intro.
Ja, wir lassen uns jetzt vorstellen.
Wir werden immer fauler im Intro. Und
wie im Leben.
Weswegen wir heute, glaube ich, nicht ganz so faul sind. Wir werden uns heute mal in Englisch versuchen.
Wow, das ist eine Premiere für uns.
Eine Premiere,
also, ja. Du hast am Anfang schon mal zu den, wie gesagt, als Bewegungsarten noch in den Kinderschuhen gesteckt. Hast du schon mit der Katie Zafiris,
ne? Mit der Katie habe ich schon mal einen gemacht, ja. Ist immer schwer, da ist im Nachhinein immer ein bisschen Fremdschämen.
Ja, aber genau. Wir bitten jetzt schon um euer Verständnis, wir sind ja keine Muttersprachler. Wir haben Richtig. Ja schlechtes Schulenglisch gelernt.
Genau, aber der Gast ist auf jeden Fall worthy. Okay. Und zwar, heute haben wir einen meiner alten Trainer.
Der Gregor hat Trainer. Viele zerschlissen.
Ich habe viele zerschlissen und der letzte war Joe Filial. Ich denke mal, von unseren Hörern werden ihn schon viele kennen, eigentlich, aber was er macht, wer er ist.
Ja, trotzdem hat er nicht den Stellenwert, den er haben müsste.
Den er haben müsste, ja. Denn gerade zur Zeit, man muss es ja, er hat zur Zeit eigentlich mit die weltbeste Triathlon-Squad, die es auf der Kurzdistanz gibt.
Ja.
Er hat das bei den Männern das komplette Podium der Saison 2018 overall in der WTS, trainiert bei ihm.
Ja.
Ganz neuer Zugang, Non Stanford, Weltmeisterin 2013, trainiert jetzt auch bei ihm.
Ja,
mit Stars gespickte Trainingsgruppe.
Er trainiert eigentlich alle Stars aktuell auf der Kurzdistanz, außer die Norweger.
Außer die Norweger, kann man so sagen.
Das müssen wir ihn natürlich auch fragen, was er zu den Norwegern.
Was er davon hält.
Ja.
Genau, ihn ein bisschen vorstellen, vielleicht, wie er überhaupt es geschafft hat, sich diese Gruppe da aufzubauen.
Und vielleicht kannst du einfach nochmal was erzählen, wie so das Training bei ihm war. Hart, aber herzlich.
Hart, aber herzlich.
Lang und ausdauernd.
Lang und soft.
Nee, aber wie lange hast du bei ihm trainiert?
Es war letztendlich recht kurz. Also wenn man mal eine halbe Saison, sagen aber wir mal so.
Du hast also
ich bin im Herbst 2015 zu ihm gewechselt und habe meine letzte Saison quasi, also das Jahr 2016, unter seiner Herrschaft bestritten sozusagen. Und ja, es war für mich ein, es war, wie gesagt, nur eine Saison, aber ich habe irgendwie unglaublich viel aus dieser Zeit mitgenommen. Es war irgendwie eine sehr, sehr intensive Zeit. In der Art und Weise, wie Joel das Training angeht, also ich habe ja schon immer mal so ein bisschen was erzählt, die Art, also wie ich gesagt habe, dieses, das werdet ihr bestimmt noch hören, also hundertprozentig, das Schlagwort wird fallen, Frequency.
Trainingsfrequency.
Die Trainingsfrequenz, das ist, glaube ich, wenn es sich nicht geändert hat, aber es müsste immer noch Joels Schlagwort Nummer 1 sein und so war das eigentlich. Also es geht los und Tag für Tag, Woche für Woche, Monat für Monat,
Sag mal eine Zahl zu den Wochen. Einfach nur so roundabout.
Die Zahlen sind nicht großartig beeindruckend. Sagen wir mal, schwimmen, ich war mal etwas weniger, zu irgendwas zwischen 25 und 35 Kilometer im Schwimmen.
So viel sind nicht beeindruckend.
Nicht
in norwegischem Maße.
Nee, da machen andere mehr.
Das
ne?
ist richtig, ja.
Auch aber Radfahren roundabout um die 300, 350, laufen so 80 bis 100. Das sind jetzt alles keine Zahlen, wo gerade Profi-Triathleten sagen würden, wow, das überzeugt jetzt aber. Aber wirklich, also durchgängig, oder ich will jetzt nicht sagen ohne Pause, aber ja, letztendlich ohne Pause. Also ich war irgendwann im April, war ich irgendwann fast schon so ein bisschen durch und habe gedacht, oder so ein bisschen früher, so im März gedacht, so oh, irgendwie einfach mal eine Woche Entlastung, das würde mal gut tun, so Beine hoch, ne? Aber irgendwann habe ich dann auch gemerkt, ich hätte natürlich viel länger bei ihm bleiben sollen, dann wäre, glaube ich, der Effekt viel, viel stärker zu spüren gewesen. Irgendwann gewöhnt sich dieser Körper dran und du steckst diese Belastung, diese permanent bestehen bleibende Belastung, die steckst du irgendwann weg. Mhm. Und und auch ich habe eigentlich diesen Schub gespürt, auch gerade im Laufen, was so meine stärkste Disziplin war, diesen Schub gespürt. leider habe ich dann irgendwann auch, gerade auch wegen dem Olympia-Debakel, zu früh aufgehört, um, ich sag mal, die Früchte auszukosten. Aber wie gesagt, das zeigt ja mit allen Athleten durch die Bank weg, bei den Frauen wie auch bei den Männern, dass das Trainingskonzept, was er anschlägt, dass es anscheinend gut ist.
Ja.
Und
er trainiert nur Profiathleten und auch wirklich, also Fokus, Kurzdistanz, Weltspitze. So kann man zusammenfassen.
Genau,
ne? Da kann nicht jeder Hinz und Kunst sagen, hey, ich laufe 45 über 10.
Nee.
Kann ich anfangen?
Das kann
ich
nicht
in die Trainingsgruppe?
Es wollen ja auch viele rein.
Ja, aber hey, davon lebt die Trainingsgruppe ja, dass sie so stark ist. Ne? Also ich denke nur an, ich glaube, letzte Saison war es ja noch Murray und Mola.
Ja.
Ne? Also jede Trainingseinheit oder viele Trainingseinheiten nebeneinander, da entstehen ja auch.
Es gibt ja auch kritische Stimmen. Also als ich in der Gruppe war, haben ja auch einige zu mir gesagt, naja, ihr bezahlt ja letztendlich nicht den Trainer, ihr bezahlt ja die Gruppe. So kann ich natürlich nicht teilen, diese Meinung.
Ja.
Weil ich denke, dass Es ist schwer in Worte zu fassen, aber gerade da Joel, so wie ich es erlebt habe, mal sehen, wie er das selbst, ob er das bestätigen wird, ob er es nicht bestätigen wird, viel auch mit Intuition, sehr viel mit Beobachtung arbeitet. Die Möglichkeit hast du ja auch, also wir waren ja eigentlich, also er hat uns ja fast täglich im Training gesehen, wir waren eigentlich
auf der ganzen Welt, immer in Camps zusammen.
Zu einer ganzen Welt, aber eigentlich fast nur in Camps zusammen und vielleicht hatte mal höchstens mal 2 Wochen, wo wir mal jeder bei sich in seinem Heimatland war, aber dann stand eigentlich schon direkt bald wieder das nächste Camp an. Und diese Erfahrung und dieser tägliche Umgang, der, glaube ich, bei ihm auch sehr, sehr wichtig ist. Ich bin mal gespannt, ob er das alles so bestätigen wird. Den bringt er rein. Und ich bin auch mal gerade gespannt, wie er das im Vergleich vielleicht zu den Norwegern nimmt. Norweger, die jetzt gerade so, vielleicht ist der norwegische Trainer in Deutschland vielleicht sogar bekannter als Joel. Und auch seine Art zu arbeiten mit den ganzen VO2-Max-Werten und den ganzen Daten viel populärer. Gerade hat auch Vincent Louis, inzwischen auch ein Athlet bei Joel, auf die Frage VO2 Max, was wäre sein Wert, hat gesagt, keine Ahnung, weiß ich nicht. Und wenn er es nicht weiß, glaube ich auch, weiß es Joel nicht.
Ja, dann
weil Joel macht, also hat mit uns auch nie irgendwelche Tests gemacht.
Ja.
Wie auch, er arbeitet ja nicht für einen Verband, er kommt an die ganzen, Ressourcen kommt er nicht ran. Sie arbeiten eigentlich mit relativ einfachen Mitteln, sage ich mal. Und ja.
Der Erfolg gibt ihm ja recht. Also es ist ja nicht so, dass er nur mal so ein One-Hit-Wonder geschaffen hat, sondern kontinuierlich, immer Podium, ITU.
Kontinuierliche Erfolge durch, wie er sagen wird, kontinuierliche Arbeit.
Frequency. Würdest du sagen, das war das, klar, es waren jetzt nicht, ihr habt vielleicht nicht so viele Testinstrumente etc. benutzt wie früher, aber war das das professionellste Umfeld, in dem du je trainiert hast?
Nein.
War es nicht?
Ich denke nicht. Also ich möchte auf keinen Fall per se sagen, dass das Umfeld, was wir in der Nationalmannschaft haben, unprofessionell war. Es war sehr intensiv und es war eine Gruppe, die, es war eine sehr motivierende Zeit. Weißt du, wenn du in dieser Gruppe bist und wie es vielleicht zu Anfangszeiten war, kann ich noch nicht so sagen, als die Gruppe noch nicht so im Fokus stand, aber später wechselst du ja im Prinzip in diese Gruppe, wo sich schon so viele Athleten bewiesen haben und damit hast du ja auch automatisch eine riesige Motivation. Auch allein schon, weil wenn du dieses Leben wählst, das ist nämlich das Zweite, es war eine sehr, sehr intensive Zeit. Ja, gerade weil du gibst so viel finanzielle Mittel, gibst du da rein.
Ja.
Du musst natürlich die Trainingslager zahlen. Joel muss auch von fast leben. Du musst natürlich auch ihn bezahlen.
Ja.
Allein da ist die Motivation hoch. Jeder, der dort ist, der brennt quasi dafür. Und insofern war das vielleicht die Zeit, wo ich in der am motiviertesten Gruppe trainiert habe.
Das klingt sehr plausibel, ja.
Ja.
Wir werden ihn mit Fragen löchern und entschuldigen uns jetzt schon für unser Englisch, aber hey, man wechselt
aber mit seinen Aufgaben. Aber wir lassen einfach Joel die meiste Zeit quatschen.
He can talk. Und er wird dafür natürlich auch nicht bezahlt. Ja, von daher muss er trotzdem talken. Sehr gut. Viel Spaß.
Viel Spaß.
Ja, Joe Filion.
So, Joel, thank you for being our guest today, and welcome to the show.
Thanks very much for having me, guys.
Joel, so I think in the short distance scene, you are very famous. You have one of the best training squads in the world, but as you know, as I was an athlete of your squad as well, in Germany it's more about the long distance athletes and the long distance coaches. So I guess you are not the most famous athlete here in Germany. So I think it would be a good start if we introduce you, or better, you introduce yourself. How did you get a coach, and how did you develop your training squad, which is like, for Germany, it's like a unique...
It's like Bayern Munich of short distance triathlon, the training squad you have. So Mayo Mola and I can't name them all because I think you had the podium of the ITU last year, right?
Yeah. The World Series in the men. Anyway.
In the men. All right. Yeah, but you will start at the beginning first.
Sure, yeah. Well, I started when I was a junior triathlete in Canada. I'm originally from Canada, though I live in the UK now, and also in Italy now. So I'm a global citizen now. But I started racing myself. I wasn't terribly good, but it developed into coaching. And I was fortunate to be offered an opportunity to move out to Victoria in British Columbia, where the Canadian National Center was just after Simon Whitfield had won the first gold medal in the Sydney Games. And there I was doing some coaching at the time, but that was the introduction to real coaching, and really developed in that environment, learning from Simon. I mean, at that time, Peter Reed had been part of that environment, and one of the drivers to get it going was actually Peter, to invite people out there to train. It was known in Canada for, of course, good weather compared to many places, but the start of that environment was in the just before the Sydney Olympics, and it grew from there. So that's where I developed, was learning to coach on deck and learning from Simon. At that time, there was also Greg Bennett and Laura Reback, and then Laura Bennett. It was a great environment to learn, and I learned a huge amount from Simon, and that developed until the Athens Olympics, and then Simon was looking for a change in his personal coaching, and I had spent some time there getting to know him and as an assistant coach of the environment. But when he was ready for a change, it was also the right time for me, and that was probably the start of the first sort of private squad that I was doing that developed out of the National Center there. And then we got rolled back into the National Center, as sometimes happens. But that Olympic cycle from Athens to Beijing was really forming for me as a coach, and to have the opportunity to work with an athlete like Simon. I'm sure I learned more from him than from me, but it was the right time, the right moment for us to develop. And so that squad environment really was born in those years.
And how old have you been at that point?
I was born in 78, so I was quite young at that time. Simon is older than I am.
Wow.
By 2 years. But, I took a different path to coaching in that way. I mean, I didn't spend many years in school studying. In fact, when I moved out to Victoria, I had finished but not finished a university degree. I was halfway through, and formal education, I'd say, wasn't for me at the time. But I was very fortunate to have so many kind of doors open like that. And so, yes, very young and inexperienced. I probably didn't know a lot, but I think managed to get some things right and really learn along the way, as often happens. You know, you have the opportunity, and was able to learn. And you know, that cycle culminated with Simon returning to the Olympic podium and an amazing race in Beijing.
Beijing, yeah. Joel, do you hear us?
I mean, it was really a spectacular finish. And then after that, it was a good time for me to make a change, and I moved over to Great Britain and took the role of the head coach there. And I did that role for 2 years, but what I found is I missed the direct connection with the athletes. It was at the time the way the role was structured was I guess a non-coaching head coach, more like a traditional high performance director or manager, and probably wasn't the right time and the right moment for me to keep doing that. So I thought I would branch off, and really that was the start of then this current squad was forming just before and then after the London Games.
How do you start a squad like that? Do you use social media and asking, hey, I want to start a squad. Does anyone want to train with me?
Yeah, you know, I mean, social media at the time probably wasn't as significant as it was now. But yeah. But actually, I did reach out to some athletes via Twitter direct message. And I mean, thinking about who might be a good fit, who could be available. I mean, even at that time, you kind of knew what other people were doing, and also a combination of other coaches that knew athletes that were looking for a change. And I mean, after the end of every Olympic cycle, there's often movement, and I was really lucky and fortunate that there was some really incredible athletes that were looking to do something different. And so just after the London Games and the final was in Auckland in New Zealand. It was sort of a late final. We had some meetings with some athletes and really started from there. I met Rich Murray there and Mario there. And that was the start of the current iteration of the squad that I was doing. And it's just grown from there. You know, I mean, again, fortunate that, you know, if you can have the opportunity to work with athletes like Mario, like Rich at the time, then get enough things right, then, you know, success attracts more athletes. And we were able to professionalize what we were doing from that point. And it continues to this day. I might describe my primary job now. I work for the Italian Federation as the performance director.
Yeah.
And the squad is it's not exactly a side project, but it's quite complementary to the work that we do with the Italian Federation. And it continues. We've been really, as I say, fortunate to work with a great group of athletes, and it changes over time. Hopefully it doesn't change too quickly at any one time, but there's been a turnover. But we've had some of the same athletes since that first camp that we did. The first real camp was in January 2013.
Yeah.
And so some of the athletes have stayed. The longest was probably Tommy Zafaris, although now he's I wouldn't say he's retired from the main squad, but obviously he's really developed as an extremely talented photographer. So working for the ITU, but
very supportive husband. Yeah.
Yeah. So Mario and Carol were some of the first, and Vendela Frintor from the Czech Republic, and others from the beginning. But yeah, there's some turnover over time, but no, it's been a really great experience, and lucky it keeps going.
And yeah. You said that you had to take care that the chemistry in the group, that everything works well and that the group fits together. Do you have or do you get questions from elite athletes these days who you say, no, you can't join us because you think it will not work in the group atmosphere?
Yeah, I mean, I certainly look and think about the personalities of athletes. I mean, we're fortunate in a way where we're essentially full, so it's not really an opportunity very often for new athletes to come in. But absolutely, personality is important, and you know, I suppose there's a kind of screening process to understand if we can anticipate any issues or problems that might come up. I mean, we have a particular way of operating, a vibe, an energy, and that's really important. So athletes have to be able to fit into the existing culture. Of course, everyone that joins has some impact on that culture, but it's something that's important, and it's part of our success is how we operate on a day-to-day basis and how athletes are able to manage themselves. That's one of the most important factors, I think, is this like self-discipline and self-control, and in a competitive environment, we have to preserve that. And because one of the principles I think that has enabled us to find some consistency and in both in training but in competition is that control. So we can't have things develop into super competitive training all the time. We have to, of course, work hard and they have to support each other, but we're not about setting records in training. We really think that's an important principle for us.
Are you concerned that it could be too competitive? If you look, you have now the complete podium in the men. You have with Katie Zafaris the second place in the WTS and non-Stanford, a former world champion. Do you think there could be too much stars in a group? Because if everyone wants to be world champion, it doesn't fit any longer.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting one. I certainly thought about that over time. I think it depends a lot on the individual personalities. And again, coming back to the culture that we try to have and try to build, that we don't want to be competitive. We want the level to be good. And that's one of the things about a group environment is it tends to raise the level of everyone. And it raises, in general, the consistency of everyone. You can have a slightly off day, but then you can kind of go in the back. You can go in the back of the lane or at the back of the group, and others are the ones that are keeping the pace going on that day, and then vice versa another day. But I think, if I reflect back to the pre-Gold Coast time, and we went into the final with the three guys ranked 1, 2, 3, yeah, and they were able to train together, right until race day. And it was one thing that I thought was really nice, and that's the athletes doing that. That's not so much just me, the athletes really make the culture. I've tried to set parameters, but it's become, an entity in its own, so when a new athlete comes, they can adapt and they see that. And of course, as we alluded to before, you can tell who might not be a good fit for that. But these guys were able to train and support each other in a positive way without, I think, being overly competitive or worried about sort of showing their cards, if you like, in training, because that's not the way we operate. We don't train like that. So that I suppose that helps. If we were the kind of environment where, we really kind of finished every session at the limit, then that's probably a possibility that we would have to be aware of would be just pushing each other too hard. But one of the ways that we've managed that in the past also is when we do have sort of personalities that manage intensity differently or manage workload differently, of course we can run separate sessions. We don't need to have everyone doing the same sessions all the time. Mm-hmm. Back when we've had other top women training together, sometimes we chose to separate them. Particularly like on the run is where you might end up doing that a bit more. But of course we need, to have the right individual program, although probably still 90% of what they're doing is the same. But it's something we have to be aware of all the time. Yeah. I mean, you can't be complacent about it, and you have to be aware of every athlete's kind of their own self-confidence and protecting and preserving that, and reinforcing, that they don't need to sort of keep up with each other all the time. And the more they can take their confidence from doing the right process for them, the better we're going to be. That's easy to say, harder to do, because of course everyone wants to compare to each other. It's natural that they want to look at each other and compare, well, how is this athlete going compared to me on any given day? And when you've got, some high bars, meaning, some of the top athletes, it's, natural, but at the same time, we have to watch that as well for the younger athletes, that they don't smash themselves trying to keep up, and that's a learning curve for everyone. And often it's very subtle. If somebody is working a couple of percent higher to keep up than someone else, it's not always visible and perhaps until the end, but it's something we have to be aware of. Mm. And then the men and women function a little differently with that as well. But it's not just gender issue, but looking at personalities and how they handle it. So I guess it comes back to knowing the individual, understanding the individual, and how do we create an environment that that both supports what the individuals need, and collectively, you know, they make each other better.
Mm-hmm. So you as a coach, you almost won everything on the short distance. So what motivates you? What are your goals as a coach?
I just think about how do we keep getting better. You know, I mean, I guess it gets a bit cliche to say that, but it's true. You know, like, yes, for some of the athletes, the level of the degree of between success and failure is pretty small. But at the same time, that's motivating to keep getting better. I mean, I think, you know, we had some discussions, you know, early part of our training here about this season, and we have to behave as we're starting from zero. You know, that that we have to improve, we have to get better in order to continue to be successful, and everyone around the world is always getting better. It's often, again, subtle and small ways, but you have to keep getting better, and there's always ways what we can do that. I mean, I think, you know, every single day there are opportunities to get the, you know, tweak the formula, to adapt things, and although we do a lot of things the same year on year, it's the small things that can make the difference. The type of sessions we're doing, you know, we started talking about what we were doing today. We just come from running hills, and this year we're running hills longer than we've done other years, and it's on a different day. It's instead of the fartlek or track that we might do on a Tuesday, we're doing a longer hill block. So there's smaller things that we can change and adapt. I mean, we have to think of how and why are we successful. I think it's important to understand that, but at the same time behave as though, you know, we're not better than everyone else. We have to earn the right to be on the top of the podium every single year and every single race. And so, you know, it's like the mentality to start from zero, really, every year. But what motivates me with the individuals is that partnership that we have with each one, and it's different for everyone. And it's not necessarily what level of success they've achieved, but about who they are as a person and what they want from me, and what tools I can use to get the best from them. But it's that partnership that motivates me the most. Going through the highs, the lows. I mean, the highs are great, but, you know, it's never going to be easy. So there's always going to be low points, you know, whether injuries or bad performances or something unexpected, or can be outside of sport as well. So, you know, going through that process with the athletes is what makes it interesting. And, you know, there's never 2 days that are the same. So, you know, that relationship is what motivates me. And I mean, I guess from a point of view of it's very difficult to replicate some of the success. You know, it's unlikely, I suppose, to be able to take a full podium in a series, but, you know, so we need to appreciate what we've achieved. But at the same point, you know, I think in sport, kind of what you get being successful is the right to continue to try, you know, and to continue to participate, and you know, that just keeps the door open, really. So, you know, I appreciate that opportunity just to keep practicing, if you like, and keep trying to get better.
So, and I think not many of our listeners know that you have a podcast or had a podcast. So maybe, yeah, it's called the Real Coaching Podcast. And in fact, it was maybe the podcast which, started me doing a podcast. And if it was called the Real Coaching Podcast, we can speak more about like your training philosophy. So, what is real coaching for you?
Yeah, I mean, it's still there, the podcast, and I have thought about restarting it. In fact, when you contacted me, it was also motivation to, you know, I should start this, because. This kind of information, you know, there's a lot about, you know, now there's a lot more, you know, age group focused and perhaps more long distance focused, but there's not something that's perhaps focused so much on ITU and short distance racing. So there's potentially something of interest, and I do get a lot of people that ask me about it, even though it's been 2 years since I did the last episode. But about training, I mean, that was the motivation to share a little bit. And I was doing that with a colleague, Paulo Souza, We also had a training squad with
Taylor Spivey.
Yeah, is in her group. Successful training
squad. For example, yeah. For the listeners, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. And Summer Cook and, many other athletes. So we enjoyed doing that and may continue. But, again, the motivation is to share a little bit of perspective and about short distance. And I think it's very interesting, although I understand, the triathlon world is different in different places. But I think, from the point of view of triathlon, I think everyone can learn something from the processes that are involved in short distance. In fact, we see more and more over time, even like training groups of long distance athletes. It's perhaps not as permanent as what we do in short distance. So maybe they come together for training camps. Maybe we could see in Lanzarote and other places, there's often groups together or perhaps slightly less formal than the type of squad that we're doing. But there's something that you can apply. I think if you have the mentality, you can learn from anyone and other sports as well. But so that was the motivation there. But in terms of like training philosophies and ideas, for sure there's some material up there. We do like. I mean, I like to think to keep things simple and accessible because I've been in and out of federations. I've had no resources and lots of resources, and so I've kind of learned and had to learn how to operate on a very small budget, if or no budget. And I think it's been interesting. I think you learn the most when you've got the fewest resources about what is effective, what makes a difference, really. I mean, because in triathlon, especially I think in long distance as well, but there's a huge industry around gadgets and technology and there's a lot of material to sort through of what is a gimmick, what is really effective, what is a kind of just something to waste time on. And technology has exploded with the ability to measure things, and I think the wisdom to be able to figure out what to do, what really makes a difference, what matters, I think is of value. And so that's how I've thought about things and tried to pick what is something that I'm going to implement that's really going to make a difference, and what should I say no to. And I think for a lot of athletes, and the message when I speak to other coaches as well is, top level success doesn't need to be complicated. It doesn't need to be, even the sort of sophistication. I mean, really, endurance training is simple. What we need to get right is to maintain health and consistency primarily. And this is accessible to anyone. You don't need to spend a lot of money or have a lot of gadgets or it's not a technical thing. Understanding yourself, understanding your athletes are skills that are accessible to everyone. So this is what the message and what I, would try to think about as well. I mean, it's difficult because there's always something new coming out. I mean, we experiment with different products and tools, but often it comes back to what can we consistently implement, what can make a difference, and what's not just a distraction or what's going to help us do a better job every day. And so I always come back to I started with sports science mentality and background, but probably over time that's driven to be more and more simple. We don't do the traditional early season, a bunch of lab testing, we don't put people on the VO2 machines or we don't do any lactate testing. We don't do anything like that. I find what's effective is just getting started in training, watching the athletes, getting them repeating similar patterns and learning where their level is at. And every day, every session is a kind of test. We don't need to go into a formal setting to do that. And I suppose we've got the benefit of a process that's been going on a long time. So, you know, there's a lot of data that's been accumulated and observations and but a simple approach, I think, is very effective in endurance sport, and you know, is something that, you know, you don't need a lot of staff to do. You don't need a lot of helpers. You don't need to spend a lot of money in testing and all of this to be great as an endurance athlete.
I'm a little bit shocked now, Joel, because I thought I need a running power meter to go sub 30 over 10. So you say no or what?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
We did a bit in the Real Coaching podcast about running power meters, for example, and it's one of the interesting things. It's like, how do you filter out what's real and what's you know, what potentially could have value? We don't know yet. I mean, I don't like to test things that are not necessarily that I don't know yet on my top athletes. I prefer I'll let somebody else figure it out if it's valuable. I mean, I don't necessarily worry too much about sort of being behind the curve with some of this stuff, because if it turns out to be valuable, then it, you know, these things will be widely adopted, like power meters turned out to be. I mean, GPS watches, you know, everyone uses these tools now. They're widely available, but you know, the introduction of sort of, you know, very cost-effective accelerometers and gyroscopes, for example, you know, have found their way into all kinds of devices and to measure, you know, pseudo power or all kinds of things. But of course, the interesting part is the algorithm any good? You know, or is it just sort of, you know, close enough? We don't know. I mean, I guess you can find a way to have value in everything, but there's a lot of pseudoscience in sport, or, you know, it's not so scientific. It has the appearance of looking scientific, but in any case, I mean, that's not to say there won't be value in some of these things. But you know, my point is always that we don't necessarily need these things. So we all have a limited amount of time and attention to give to these things. And, particularly at the sharp end of the sport where really we eat, sleep, train, there's not a whole lot of time for other stuff. And in triathlon, you know, even analysis time, I mean, you got to pick and choose as well, right? If you're a age group athlete or a working athlete, or you're training a lot, you know, you don't necessarily have a ton of time. You need to find out what the key information was quickly. What does it mean? Do you need to make a decision? Does it help you make a decision one way or the other? You know, add it to the bigger pool of data about where you're at, and then you move on. I think even with all of this ability to measure everything, explaining performance is still not always easy. You know, we can still have a bad day and not understand why, you know, have good days and not necessarily. It doesn't
Didn't
necessarily
see it
make
coming.
Sense either. Yeah, I mean, not necessarily. You know, so I mean, we use all of these, you know, power GPS. I program my training on Training Peaks, so the web platform Training Peaks. So data analysis is easy. It's at your fingertips. It's on your phone. It's on your computer at all times. That stuff has been fantastic for communication and simple analysis. I mean, you used to have to download or get files, you know, emailed to you, and you dump it into your SRM software or Golden Cheetah or something like that before. But this has all been changed to make it a lot easier. And that has been revolutionary, I think, for coaching athletes and having that data at your fingertips. You know, but beyond that, it's, you know, not doesn't necessarily continue to add value. So I mean, having a skeptical mind about where you're going to put your time and attention now is valuable.
Okay. No, it's just because we have this topic right now, because in Germany right now, everybody's talking about the, of course, success of the Norwegian guys.
Oh, we have the same feeling. Oh, right. Yeah.
Got it. And it seems they have a little different approach, and they use many of the devices and all that gadgets. Do you talk to the Norwegian coaching staff?
Which is like the opposite way of yours, it seems like.
A little bit, yeah. What do you think about this? Or do you talk to the coaches? What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, you know, good timing. The Norwegian group just arrived here where we are in Fuerteventura this morning. Okay. Here yesterday, I think.
Of course, we knew that, Joe. We knew that.
I talked to Arald for a few minutes this morning. But yeah, I mean, they're, you know, what is, I prefer to look at it, what is common. They train a lot. They control the intensity. They do a lot of sub-threshold work, you know, which may be sort of out of fashion from the sense of this sort of gray zone business. You know, some 10 years ago, people worried about this middle intensity, but, you know, the volume of work that they're doing is significant. I did a presentation for the Italian coaches a couple of months ago, and I used Christian's end of the year Instagram story where he showed his training peaks, and as an example, you know, these guys are training a lot in endurance sport, being aerobically fit and robust and fatigue resistant. Comes from a lot of volume and a lot of frequency, you know, and I think what they use these tools to manage intensity. I mean, I understand why, you know, they use lactate to understand what intensity they're doing and to be in the right range.
And you don't have a feel you need it as well?
No, I've been there and experimented with it and decided that for me, that information didn't actually change very much of what I did. And it's a bit of a hassle to do. And I found that, you know, with anything like that, the question I ask myself is, if I get this information, what am I going to do differently? Mm. And I found myself not doing really anything differently. And I think it's the issue with a lot of testing and lab testing is, you know, what the value for me is, if I do these tests, am I going to change what I'm going to do coming up? So if we don't achieve whatever we thought we were going to achieve in this current training block, are we going to change it or, you know, to do more of, I don't know, sub-threshold or more of VO2 max? And the answer to me is no, because the demands of the sport are what they are, and there's competitions coming up, and you don't necessarily have time to go back and redo something. And so it becomes a bit of, you know, confirmation, you know, or, you know, is it real that, you know, or do these athletes always have good tests? You know, does it always confirm what they were doing anyway? And if the answer is yes, then my question, why do you spend the time to do them? And certainly my experience with top level athletes over time is they don't particularly enjoy being tested. It's stressful. Mm. Often unnecessary. And many of the kind of athletes now, maybe they have their culture is a little different, but many of the athletes that I know are not the kind of athletes where you're going to produce meaningful numbers in a laboratory. You know, when I think of Simon Whitfield, when I think of Alistair Brownlee, when I think of a lot of these kind of really spectacular athletes, they're not the kind of guys that are going to do a max test for you on a treadmill. You're not going to find out the limitations or the limits, or, you know, you might find something out, but the question is, what are you going to do differently? And for me, in my work, the answer was, well, we have a process that we're following and we're going to adapt it, but I'm going to adapt it more what I see over time, not on any given day. And I don't want to stop what we're doing to test when we could keep doing what we're doing. Because inevitably, you know, on any given test, if you don't rest for it, is it meaningful? If it's during a training block, are you going to get a valid measure? I would argue in the same way, if you race in the middle of a training block and you've not adequately prepared, you're also not going to get a great. And so can I kind of reach that point, you know, going through the process. I used to have a lactate probe meter. I used to play around with it and try to learn what we were doing. And I found we just didn't change very much. So, you know, I certainly respect the process of others. You know, there's lots of different ways to get there. And they have a particular culture, you know, from perhaps other sports. It might come from skiing, you know, that it's a hugely successful winter sport country. And skiing, there's cross-country skiing is an interesting sport to learn from. They have a lot of data historically. They have, you know, there's lots of studies and on various athletes about how much they've trained over their whole careers, the intensity breakdown. It has that kind of culture, so it's not surprising that, you know, up to who they know that's successful, then you know, in their own community, in their own culture, then they might adopt some of those things. And I think a lot of those principles are good. And you know, there's some things that are different, but like in a lot of sport settings, you know, probably there's more in common than not. You got to find a way that's going to be right for your own environment. And your own experience. So, you know, I've been watching the success they've had. It's been fantastic and really extraordinary from a small country without a big history. And you know, for sure there's something to be learned there. And, you know, when we watch what they do and, you know, may adopt some of these things. But then there's other things that, you know, that's quite individual about, you know, our own process. We all have to find our own way. You know, we were at the pool this morning doing sessions at the same time. Mm-hmm. We had quite a lot of, you know, the top 10 in any given race is training mm-hmm. at the same time today. But you know, the small community of our sport, you know, it's not such a big sport. And, you know, often we find ourselves in the same places. And, you know, it's been really interesting watching their success. Like I say, I think it's been, you know, useful and motivating and inspiring to continue to get better.
I would like to switch topics a little bit because the news came up these days that Javi Gomez is focusing on 2020 Olympics. Are you surprised by that, or do you thought he would try to win Hawaii? What do you think about this? Because I guess he will be 37.
Yeah. Of course, yeah. I mean, you saw the news like everyone else. I didn't know, and I don't know Javi super well, but of course, having spent and watched many years, mm-hmm. I guess I'm not surprised. He's an athlete that has had a massive amount of success and expects a lot of himself, and it was really big shame for him that he wasn't able to participate in the Rio Games, you know, and I'm sure that for him that left something unfulfilled, you know, that he was near the peak of his powers and he wasn't able to go on the start line because of the crash that he had on his bike and, you know, broken bones. And that would have been a fantastic race for him. You know, it's hard to go past him winning gold there if he was on the start line. But, you know, so he may feel he has got unfinished business and, you know, so not surprised. And then he wants to win no matter what he's doing. And
do you think he can win? He still can win at 37?
I mean, we would never count somebody out like him, you know. I would say the best predictor of future success is past success. Obviously, sort of age isn't on his side, but knowing the he is and has been, you know, I'm sure that he can be right at the top again. And I know that's what he wants to do. He'd be motivated to do that. He wouldn't come back unless he believed he could be competitive. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I'm sure that he's the greatest ITU athlete in history, you know, and his success speaks for itself. So it will be fun to watch and interesting to watch, and I'm sure it will have an impact on the race. Obviously, we know his skill set. Mm-hmm. He's a fantastic swimmer, great rider, great runner. He's one of the complete athletes in that way, and it'll be interesting to see what he does. But I think you could never count him out, and you know, I think all of his competitors feel the same. They have huge respect for what he's achieved and who he is as an athlete, and I'm sure he'll make an impact.
And if we talk about Javi, who did his Ironman Hawaii debut this year. No, last year. We already have 2019. So don't you think it's like he wasn't too happy about this new distance? Or maybe he feels like he's not so competitive in long distance like on the short distance? So switching back, because for me it was really unexpected. I was thinking like you, okay, if Harry toes the line, he wants to win. And in my opinion, it always was okay, I would bet more money for him on winning Hawaii than winning the Tokyo Olympics. So, or am I wrong?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that's the beauty of Kona is it's a tough one to crack. I mean, whether people get it on the first try, and it's also unforgiving. You know, if you've not arrived on the start line and got your preparation right and left some energy to give on the day, then it can be really unforgiving, and you know, perhaps that's what we saw. I don't know anything about his preparation other than I know it's really difficult to get right, and of course he wanted to get it right and wanted to experience that success, and it's not uncommon that it takes more than one try. And he's had a long career. You know, I think when we talk about ITU athletes going to long distance, we don't often see them necessarily at the absolute peak of their power. It's often when they have decided they want to change or to experience something new, and that doesn't make it easier for sure. And you know, it's also the demands of the race. I mean, that's also clearly was part of it. And yeah, I have no doubt that he was unsatisfied. You know, he went there to win. I'm sure he expected, that he wanted to experience a much better performance than he had. I mean, it wasn't, you know, bad, but it wasn't great. And he's an athlete that we know that expects a lot of him from himself and knows he can win. And I'm sure that played some part in it. But yeah, I mean, it's a very tough race. It's what makes Kona special. We know that. I mean, from, you know, it's a historical and legendary race for that reason, because the conditions are so extreme that, if you're not on your best day, it can be really difficult. And it's also very specific. You know, not everyone is great in the hot conditions. Some people have to learn how to do it. And, you know, and certainly the demands of the bike have been very high, and no doubt that's played a role as well. So, yeah, I mean, it would be nice in a way for as a fan of the sport if he could fully commit, you know, a few years to see what's possible. But then we have this Olympics here, and perhaps he feels that he can come back to long distance if he gives Tokyo a crack, and maybe more chance of having success after doing this than certainly going the other direction if he waits. You know, he's not gonna be competing in Paris in 2024. That would be probably a step too far. So he feels it's now or never, I'm sure. And we won't necessarily get to see him fully focus on Kona, at least in the next year.
Yeah. So time is flying, as we see right now. So, but I still have one last question, and we are a German podcast, so the last question is about maybe long distance. I have, Joey, you know it. Germany is about long distance triathlon. So, could we see a Hawaii podium, or could we see you as a coach of a Hawaii podium contender in 1 year? Not switching, but like training high class long distance athlete and maybe help him to conquer Hawaii.
I guess it's whether you have the opportunity. I have coached a lot of Ironman athletes in the past, more some years ago. When David McNamee switched from ITU, we worked to one Kona, his first one, where he was 11th, and then he moved on and achieved much bigger success afterwards. But I mean, I like to think the principles are the same. Getting the most out of athletes are the same. I think it would be interesting to try to reintegrate it in the kind of environment that we do now. But on the other hand, I'm not likely to do this forever either. So I think it depends on the opportunity. Certainly, I feel I've become more and more specialized in short distance, and that's where my the professional market for myself is obviously fully focused on that now. But I have great respect for all parts of triathlon. I think that's what's interesting about triathlon is there's so much to the sport. It's not one dimensional in that way. And, you know, and a huge respect for Kona as an event and the Ironman process. I think it's not so different in the end. You know, the amount of volume, the amount of work that we're doing in top level triathlon is not so different. And so I think there's a lot of transfer in that. So time will tell in the future if that's a possibility. But at the moment, I'm fully focused on the Olympic Games, and you know, who knows post 2020. Maybe I follow a path like a lot of the ITU athletes, where I might retire from the grind of the travel and following the Olympic path and take a different path and focus more where I have opportunities in other kinds of triathlon.
So to all the young long-distance athletes out there, you heard Joel. Don't rule him out. Perhaps he will be your coach.
But Joel, leave your time. If I mean, you're very good in the short distance, the ITU scenery.
That's for sure, yeah. Thank you very much.
Joel, thank you very much for the talk.
Appreciate it.
Thank you, guys. I enjoyed the chat.
And yeah, we wish you a good training camp in Fuerteventura, Playitas.
Playitas.
Fuerteventura, yeah, we're doing a long block here. We're here until March. So
wow. Okay.
And then you're switching to Mallorca, or
we switched to Mallorca in April, March and April. And we have a short break after the Abu Dhabi World Series, but yeah, then we switch there. So we just keep going. Eat, sleep, train, and stay in the environment, stay in the squad. To maximize our process every day
and win races, that's for sure. That's
we try.
Yeah. All right. No. All the best for the year, for the season. Stay healthy, and of course, best wishes to all of your athletes. Gregor knows them, many of them, but have a great year.
Cheers to them.
Thank you.
Bye.
Yeah, Gregor, we miss you.
All right. All right, let's come back to German. Das war Joel.
Joel Filio.
Und erzählen wir die kleine Lücke, die wir hatten, die euch wahrscheinlich aufgefallen sein wird. Erzählen wir die Story so, wie sie war.
Ja, bitte. Also nur die absolute Wahrheit.
Also ein paar Mal waren wahrscheinlich auch ein paar Aussätze wegen, also ne, Joel auf Plaitas, Internet und so. Ich könnte es auch drauf schieben, dass das Internet für diesen einen Ruck
der
Schuld war.
Der war schon ziemlich lang, ne? Also es war ja schon 4, 5 Sekunden.
Der war ein paar Sekunden. Mhm. Was war los? Ich habe, um mit der Zeit zu gehen, und so ein bisschen so von diesen ganzen Social Media Gedöns wegzukommen. Ich habe mir ein Limit gesetzt.
Kann man jetzt bei den neuen iOS-Versionen.
Genau, hier kannst du so Bildschirm, kannst du sagen, okay, so und so viel Social Media am Tag und dann sperrt er quasi ab.
Skype zählt zu Social Media.
Und das war mir nicht klar. Weißt du, für mich war das so Facebook und Instagram und so. Ja. Ich habe zwar so WhatsApp und so alles rausgenommen, damit ich so erreichbar bin, aber und auf einmal fängt er an so, ja, sorry, deine Social Media Zeit ist abgelaufen. Und ich habe dann noch so schnell gedrückt, so, oh nein, mach weiter. Aber Joel hat gar nichts gewährt.
Joel hat einfach weiter erzählt.
Joel hat das nicht gestört.
Wir sind ihm da nicht reingegrätscht.
Genau.
Ja. Aber so passiert das. Pleiten, Pech und Pannen. Und wir sind natürlich offen und teilen die mit euch. Aber ja, coole Insights vom erfolgreichsten Coach, kann man sagen.
Short-Distance-Coach zurzeit, ja.
Und man muss nicht alles messen, bestimmen, auswerten, sondern manchmal ist gutes Körpergefühl auch viel wert, oder?
Körpergefühl, you need
trust your body,
get the group together,
yeah, and the group environment, and yeah, good stuff will happen.
Bei Joel ist es immer so ein bisschen so, er erzählt ja viel, aber es bleibt immer ein bisschen mystisch, ne? Letztendlich, so genau wie er es macht, weiß man nicht, ne? Aber es ist halt wirklich die Beobachtung.
Yeah.
Das fällt mir auch mal schwer zu.
Perhaps one day I will coach a Hawaii champion, but right now I'm focusing on short distance stuff. Auf jeden Fall, finde ich auch ein bisschen mystisch, aber total interessant. Und der ganze Partner mit der Kerl, ich kann sie nicht. Gregor hat alles bei ihm gelernt. Und ja, es hat Früchte getragen. So.
Wir hoffen, euch hat es gefallen. Und verabschieden uns von euch.
Freuen uns auf die nächste Sendung.
Macht es gut.
Bis bald.
Tschö.
Ciao.